Welcome, Peeps readers. This is the first of what we hope to be many audio pieces. Dr. Katerina Tewa of Australian National University shares the story of a small island in the South Pacific called Banaba. Found to be rich in phosphate, a mineral needed to enrich increasingly industrialized and depleted soil throughout the British Empire, Dr. Tewa speaks to the cultural and material impact of colonization of the island, providing a picture of a part of the world we rarely get to hear much about. Our senior editor, Kristen Kafer, interviewed Katerina to share her story.
So thank you for joining us today, Katerina. To start, because many of us probably don't know, could you tell us where Banaba Island is located?
Yes, thank you, Kristen, and thank you for having me on your program. So Banaba is in the central Pacific. It is an island in the Republic of Kiribati, and it is about 2.5 square miles or about 6 square kilometers. So it's right there in the middle of the vast Pacific, not too far from Nauru, its closest neighbor. However, you can't see Nauru or any other island from Banaba. So if you were to stand on Banaba and turn for 360 degrees, you would not see another island. Thus, it's one of the more isolated islands in the Pacific. It would take you about 2 or 3 days to get to the capital of Kiribati, which is Tarawa. That's 2 or 3 days by ship. So it really is right there in the middle of the Pacific, just below the equator.
Thanks for helping us get our bearings. Now, phosphate seems to play a big role in the recent history of the Banaban people. I find that really interesting. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
So Banaba, like Nauru, is or was almost completely made of phosphate or calcium phosphate, which is a sedimented form of phosphate that builds up in between limestone pinnacles. It took thousands and thousands of years for this phosphate to build up. And there are two sources of the phosphate. One, which is more well-known and I suppose exists in the popular imagination, is guano or bird droppings. So bird droppings from the sky, bird droppings from birds that nest on the island because it's one of the few places in the vast Pacific that they can stop and rest and nest and have their babies. The other source of phosphate is maritime phosphate. So phosphate that comes from marine life, decayed marine life from underneath the sea that builds up over time and due to the pressure of the ocean becomes part of that sedimented phosphate, but it fuses together with the guano and then with the help of the water pressure become this old sedimented rock phosphate. So phosphate is really key to almost all processes of life. Without phosphate, nothing can survive. It is critical to mass agriculture. It is a source of fertilizer that expands and maximizes agricultural yields. So if you add phosphate to your fertilizer, you're able to grow more. So phosphate was critical to the Green Revolution in that it helped expand and maximize global agriculture, but it required resources like Banaba, like Nauru, in order for global agriculture to grow and expand as it did.
Right. So phosphate seems like it was untouched for quite some time. When did outsiders catch on and start to take advantage of the island?
So there's a famous story associated with the discovery of phosphate on Banaba. So this rock was propping up a door in the company's headquarters in Sydney. This was the Pacific Islands Company, which had been mining guano and doing other kinds of trade across the region. But they started running out of guano because guano resources are quite limited. So they found all of these different guano islands, they mined them out, and they were still looking for phosphate. This company had offices in Australia, New Zealand, and in the UK, in London. It was owned by shareholders from those three countries. Really, they were all part of the British Empire at the time. So these were essentially British companies. But there was a chemist who worked in that Sydney office, and the company was getting quite desperate. So they were staring at this big rock that was popping up the door, and finally decided maybe we should test this rock. Everyone thought it was wood, so they ignored it. So they finally tested it and discovered that rock that somebody had brought back from some trip to the islands was made of pure phosphate, one of the highest grades of phosphate that they'd ever seen. They quickly tracked and traced, like, where did this rock come from? And they said, oh, this is from Nauru. So people knew where Nauru was, but it was a German territory at the time. So we're talking a British company going, eek, we found an amazing source of phosphate, but it's on an island which belongs to Germany at the time. So, you know, the British can't just rock up and start taking phosphate. So they quickly looked at the map and said, what is the island closest to Nauru? And they looked and they saw this island that, to their surprise, quote unquote, belonged to nobody, as in no European or American or other nation had claimed this island. And everybody had been very busy carving out the entire Pacific via remote control, often without indigenous people's knowledge, saying, you get that one, you get that one goes here, that one goes there, or oops, nobody owns this, quick, go get it. So they decided cleverly and strategically to go check out this island. So the ship arrives on Banaba, and one of the people leading this expedition is Albert Ellis. Albert Ellis was that chemist who tested the rock and discovered that it was made of phosphate. So he arrives with a team from the Pacific Islands Company and find that the Banabans are quite friendly and welcoming and kind of bemused that these guys want the rocks, because they get off the ships and there's not a lot of communication, you know, not a lot of people fluent in English or anything like that. But Banabans are familiar with foreigners because they already had several decades of interactions with passing ships. And at one time, they themselves had been relocated or moved to other islands on these ships because they had experienced an extreme drought. So Banaba is in this part of the Pacific that is a drought belt. However, they have underground freshwater caves, which had been a source of water for the over 2,000 years that Banabans had lived on this island. When droughts are extreme and those sources of fresh water dry up, that's when Banabans get into an extreme situation, a desperate situation. So Banabans were familiar with outsiders, but could not communicate very well with them or understand what they were saying. But when Albert Ellis and his team from the Pacific Islands Company arrived, they had very clear orders to get a lease to mine the island ASAP. So they produced a piece of paper. They identified the people who greeted them, who were men from a particular village, as the chiefs. Banaba theoretically does not have chiefs, especially not chiefs who are the boss of all the lands. But the men from this company needed to identify a leader and needed to get someone to sign the piece of paper, even though there was actually no European law that existed in this part of the world because there was no colonial administration. But nevertheless, they hodgepodged an agreement together that Banabans did not understand, especially not those from this particular village. And they asked them to put an X on the paper. And that paper said, you will allow us to mine your land for 999 years at the rate of 50 pounds per year as compensation. Now, there were probably just under 2,000 Banabans living there at the time, and each one of them had their own land. So for this team to negotiate with a few people that they identified as representative of the whole island was very problematic. But that's what happened when they arrived.
Yeah, so after mining began, Banaba was essentially turned into a colony. What did that look like?
Once they got that agreement, quote unquote, signed with an X that nobody could really read or understand, the information went back to the head offices and it eventually got back to London because Great Britain had colonies all over the Pacific and there were rules and regulations and laws and all kinds of things operating. As bad as colonialism was, you couldn't just rock up and form an agreement with people if there wasn't an actual system of regulation and governance operating in that place. And it was an illegal agreement because it existed in an empty legal space. So people in London, various MPs and members of parliament, some of whom owned shares in the company, got a bit worried. They were like, awesome, you found phosphate and you've got this agreement. Could somebody put the British flag up ASAP and quickly acquire this island for the British Empire? Because we need some form of administration on it. Banabans had no idea all of this is playing out. They are hosting these men. These men are camping on the island. They're picking up rocks. The Banabans are like, do you need some help with this? With these rocks? We'll pick up a few rocks. And the team is going, could we get these guys to mine their own island for us? Because that would be the easy way to do this. We wouldn't have to ship in any labor. You know, let's see if we can just sort of hire them to mine their island. How great. We'll employ them. They put up the British flag. And it's quickly integrated into a nearby protectorate of the Gilbert and Ellis Islands.
Right. And did Banabans benefit at all from the mining of their island?
If by benefit you mean changing a sustainable social, political, and economic context or society into one where they rely on a cash economy, then I'm not sure that's a benefit. Banabans didn't need money to get what they needed, and they ate healthy off the land and the sea. They also knew how to live in that challenging environment using their traditional ecological knowledge. They had a culture that was well integrated with that particular raised coral atoll phosphate environment. However, like most European colonizers who rock up on ships, they were offered things like cans of soup, tinned meat, canned vegetables and fruit, all kinds of things that needed to come from a store that they set up quite quickly. And sometimes they would say, okay, instead of compensating you for the land, like through this lease, what if we give you store credit? So you can get goods from the store, we can lease the land, win-win. So this is taking people away from a self-determining, sustainable state to one where they're beginning to value money and the material goods that come with it. The company transformed Banaba into a very luxurious mining town for the company employees, in that you had an industrial zone, which was the mining zone, and then you had beautiful buildings were put up, a train system was put in place. They had lots of leisure facilities, a golf course, a pool, and an outdoor movie theater for everyone. So overnight, this island is transformed into something that looks like it belongs, I don't know, in some middle of a continent somewhere, because the mining company kind of sets things up for themselves in quite a luxurious way. And so every family you know, Australian, New Zealand, British family who lives there, has like people to look after their kids and do their washing and their laundry and their cooking and their cleaning. And, you know, they set up a whole like system to keep the mine running, but also to keep themselves relatively comfortable. And they start segregating the Barnabans into villages that can be controlled better under a colonial administration. So they move people around a little bit. They identify where the best mining fields might be. They realize that the highest, most fertile grade of phosphate exists under one particular village right in the middle of the island. And so they try to put into place a system where they just kind of incrementally move slowly, slowly mining towards that village. But I've read the archives and the company and the British administration. So you have two systems operating the island. One is the company owned by the three governments, and one is the British colonial administration, which is supposed to look after the welfare of the natives. They sometimes clash because the resident commissioner is like, wow, you guys are really pushy here. You actually just want to get rid of the Barnabans. You want them out of here so that you can just mine the whole thing because they're actually an inconvenience for you. These are the kinds of debates that I see in the archives where whenever somebody tries to stand up for the Barnabans, the company goes, okay, get rid of that guy. Let's get him out of here. That happens quite consistently until they put into place administrators who just follow what the company needs and wants. Yeah, I mean, the Barnabans, some will tell you, especially the elders might say, you know, we miss those outdoor movie theaters and we miss a few things because they have this experience of like kind of an overnight sort of prosperity, but without a lot of agency and self-determination. I've read transcripts of meetings, for example, where the Barnabans go, could you explain that better to us? And they go, here's the price. And they go, is that the price for everyone globally? Like, you know, they're trying to get a sense of economically how this works. And the white man running the meeting will say, we have explained this to you. Please sign. You know, just like infantilizing the Barnabans, treating them like children when they ask them questions about what's going on. What is the value of these rocks that you're taking? Are we getting treated fairly? So Barnabans actually push back in the 20s. They get very vocal. We're talking the 1920s. And they write to the king and they say, we are your pitiable people, the Barnabans from the Pacific. And it's because at the time the resident commissioner has threatened them and said, if you don't sign this piece of paper for more land, the consequence is death. Would you like life or would you like death? So they get threatened every time they ask questions, they push back. And at the same time, from a Pacific cultural perspective, they're also trying to be friends with these Australians and New Zealanders and British, because that's the cultural context in which relations between people are supposed to be established and managed. They're trying to form kinships with these miners. And the miners are like, mate, we just want the phosphate. You know, like they're like, oh, aren't they sweet and cute? But, you know, this is pragmatic, strategic stuff we're doing over here. So these stories that I encounter in the archives they're really intense. And they're also kind of like these interesting metaphors and parables for humanity and how this same narrative is repeated all over the world as various environments are destroyed, like Barnabans.
I'd like to fast forward now. As I understand, Barnabans were moved from the island in 1945 to Fiji, and some of them returned in the 1970s. Could you describe for us what the return was like for them?
So I've just given a little context for the 1945 move. World War II happened in the Pacific in the 1940s, which means everything was disrupted, including all industrial and commercial activities like the mining on Barnaban. Japan was a buyer of Barnaban phosphate in the early 1900s. They knew that Barnaba had this very important mining industry on it. So they targeted Barnaba for occupation during World War II because it would have been seen as a strategic economic and political acquisition for them. So the company on the island realizes Japan is heading for the island and they all evacuate really quickly. They take all the Europeans, bar a few, with them, but they leave all their workers and they leave the Barnabans behind. And they suffer tremendously during Japanese occupation. 100 people are executed in one mass execution on Banaba. But the company has this narrative of, oh, the Japanese are kind of like brown like you, and you'll all get along racially and they won't treat you so bad. So there are these terrible narratives and things that are told to Banabans about why they're being left behind. So they live in Japanese war camps. My great-grandfather was someone who lived in a Japanese war camp during this period. And they suffer and they try to figure out how to survive with very, very little resources. And then they get moved to other islands because Japan has war camps on Nauru and Kostrai and Tarawa, other places. So the Barnabans get displaced because they all run out of food. And then the war ends. And what happens is the company and the British colonial administration, you know, head back to Banaba ASAP because they've continued their activities from afar in terms of stockpiling superphosphate and trying to keep the industry going. And when they come back to Banaba, they quickly see that the mines have been destroyed because it was bombed a few times. And also before the company left, they destroyed critical features of their own industry so the Japanese couldn't use it. So they couldn't get the mines going. So they realized this is an opportunity actually to move the Barnabans, not back to Banaba, but to some other island. And they've been planning this for a while. So the Barnabans had a trust fund, which was royalties from the leases to the company. So instead of giving Barnabans money, because Barnabans were seen by them to be children who couldn't handle money, they would put things in an account for them. And they would say, when you need, we can use the money in this account to do stuff. So they bought Rambi Island in Fiji using that money, Barnabans' own money. Didn't even buy it for them. They used their own income from the leases. So they bought Rambi in Fiji and they moved Barnabans from war camps straight to Fiji. They said to them, oh, the Japanese destroyed your island. This is so terrible. But look, we've bought you a new island and this island is amazing. And we're going to put houses and all kinds of great things for you on that island. Now, Barnabans are coming out of war camps and they're traumatized. And they're exhausted and, you know, they've had a terrible, terrible time. So they agree to get on the company's ships and go to Rambi. And about 1,000 people make it to Rambi. And 700 of them are Barnabans and about 300 are non-Barnabans who are married to Barnabans. And when they arrive in Fiji, December 15th, 1945, they're in the middle of a cyclone season. And Barnabans have just been relocated from the Central Pacific, which is quite dry, and there isn't a lot of rain, to a very windy, rainy, and colder part of the Pacific, because Fiji is nothing like the islands in the Central Pacific. But Europeans loved imagining that you could take one islander from one island and drop them on some other island, and they'd all be fine and go forth into the forest and live successfully, not thinking about the specificity of all of these different island environments and what it takes to learn how to live in an integrated, holistic way with your particular island. So they relocate them to Fiji in the middle of this super rainy season, and they leave them with military tents, army tents, set up for them. And Barnabans actually have retold this story over and over again for generations because they said when they arrived on the island, they were like, where are the houses? Where are all the things that were promised us when we came out of war camps? They had tents that were like soaked, you know, and then there were also cows on the island, and Barnabans had never seen a cow in their life. They, you know, the fauna on Banaba is quite different. Not to mention the indigenous people of this island had been displaced. and it had been sold to a plantation company. So they'd been growing coconut plantations on Rambi for a while. So yes, they were relocated December 15, 1945. And unfortunately, quite a few of their elders who were the keepers of the knowledge of Barnabans passed away. They survived the war camps, but by the time they got to Fiji, they got quite sick. You know, the change in temperature and the wet environment. We're told about 30 Barnabans elders who really were needed to help, you know, create this new culture on Rambi passed away. The other thing that was important, which wasn't considered when they were relocated, is that Fiji has indigenous people who belong to the land of Fiji. Even though Rambi was a freehold land, as in it was one of the few pieces of land in Fiji that could be bought or sold, there were people indigenous to Rambi and they were living in the region around Rambi. And they were very conscious that that is their ancestral land and that these people from another part of the Pacific were being brought and put there. So Barnabans always felt awkward not being on land they were ancestral to. Like, this is not their indigenous land. So there were quite a few cultural conflicts with Itauke, indigenous Fijians who belonged to that land. Nevertheless, Barnabans tried to figure out a way to reconstruct and recreate their culture. They're doing it in the absence of a lot of ancestral wisdom and knowledge that they have lost through the passing of their elders. And there also emerge a few different cultural disagreements around protocols, for example. Cultural protocols or ways of doing things emerge in place. They make sense to the place that you're from. And they don't always automatically transfer to some new context overnight in a smooth way. You know, they're dealing with loss and grief and all kinds of things after World War II. They're trying to reconstruct and recreate their culture. They're also watching Nauru very carefully, because Germany lost the war and therefore Nauru could petition for independence, which they were granted. And Barnabans are very confused as to why they can't get independence like Nauru did. So Nauru becomes an independent nation and it eventually takes over mining of their own island. So I meant to mention that the same company that's mining Barnaba eventually works it out and negotiates and gets access to phosphate on Nauru as well. So these two islands are being mined together. But Nauru gets independence after World War II and Barnaba doesn't. So Barnabans actually start petitioning the UN and other bodies and governments and the British government saying, we would like independence. We would like to be self-determining and take charge of our own land. So they're in Rambi, but they've sort of decided they will retain Barnaba. It's an important ancestral homeland, but it's actually not viable for living on because the company after World War II expanded straight into areas where villages used to be, and they start mining full on Barnaba. And what they do is they get the Barnabans to map the whole island in detail for them and tell them who owns what plot, because every man, woman, and child had access to a plot of land. And so the company just kind of works through the leases on that basis. But they start negotiating with the Rambi Council of Leaders rather than individual landowners, because Barnabans didn't own property like people today imagine property ownership. This was a very fluid system where you could exchange land for a service like healing. That's how important land was. But the company just doesn't want to deal with all of these individual landowners. They need centralization of political and economic authority, and they change the whole system of land tenure on Barnaba. So Barnabans are quite frustrated with this whole situation and also the fact that they're displaced from Banaba. They're trying to figure out how to live in Fiji. They're petitioning for independence. They're not getting too far on the independence front, including from the Gilbert Islands, because Banaba is a great source of taxes for their welfare. So Banabans prepared to actually sue the company and sue the British government. And that's why they go back to Banaba in the early 70s to occupy the island, because they're quite fed up of not having a presence, a proper presence on the island. And they want independence and autonomy over their own affairs. So they hire lawyers. They get all kinds of people, London-based lawyers. They get advice, legal advice from all over the place. And they prepare a massive lawsuit against the Crown and against the mining company, which is a whole nother level of like legal issues that people have to wade through, including early versions of this so-called lease. What are all the mining leases? Who agreed to what? It's a very interesting time when the Banabans go back, and I only discovered much later that my grandparents also went back in the 70s to as part of this occupying force on Banaba, and some of the Banabans bombed part of the mines, and Gilbertese police arrested people, and there was all kinds of clashes on the island. Meanwhile, the court case is going on in London. And the whole thing is so complex, and the global media is covering this story, and the British people are reading about it, and lots of people have sympathy for the Banabans because they're quite astounded at the differences in scale around this story. They're thinking, such a little, small, small island against the British Empire and the very differences in power garner a lot of sympathy amongst many publics. You know, we hear stories about British kids sending like £1 notes to the Banabans saying, we really want to help you in your cause. And the Banabans are very smart. They figure out how to put culture and their identity front and center in this court case. So they actually create dances and narratives about history and what happened. They tell their story through song and dance and theater. And they walk through the streets of London like people would be wearing suits. And then the Banabans in their full Banaban dancing costumes would be at the front. British people were like, whoa, what is going on? And who are these islanders? And where have they come from? And who are we to them and them to us? Like the story got really popular in the 70s, and media was covering it all over the place. And the BBC did a whole documentary on the court case, which was interesting because the judge found the whole thing so complex and so challenging and so difficult to get his head around the land agreements and what the mining had done to the island, that he flew the entire court to Banaba. And it was fascinating because then you could see the judge and everyone else kind of walking across the landscape, trying to figure out the sense and the scale of devastation, because the Banabans kept saying, you've destroyed our island and you were supposed to rehabilitate this island. You weren't supposed to like destroy and mine everything without replanting our trees. And that was one of the big dimensions of the court case, was replant our trees. Replant our trees, our coconut trees. Coconut trees were everything to Banabans, which is interesting because a lot of people think coconut trees are random things that just pop up on islands to sway in the breeze and for people to drink the juice of the coconut. But for Banabans, they could read their landscape in detail and know exactly which tree belonged to which person. And they could even recognize their own coconuts. They knew the differences between the coconuts in detail from the different trees. So the court case went on and on and on. It was a big civil lawsuit. And eventually, the Banabans did not win their case, which is part of why they were so angry and upset about the whole thing. But the judge made this statement about the moral wrong that had been done to the Banabans. There was so much sympathy for them, but he said, I can't put a monetary figure to this. Yes, you have been hard done by. However, I can't, you know, the scale of what it would take to rehabilitate the island. And I think they came up with something like, we'll give you like $75 per acre destroyed. And there was an out-of-court settlement or payment that was made, like a goodwill ex gratia payment of $10 million that was given. And that was put in a trust fund for the Bahamans. And the idea was that the interest of the principal of this would then somehow the Barnabans could figure out how to distribute across their community. I mean, $10 million was nowhere near the profits that were accrued through the mining and through the agricultural, multiple agricultural industries and commodity chains that came out of this particular 80-year mining industry. And in interesting ways, again, going back to your question about benefit, that $10 million has been the source of a lot of strife and a lot of drama over the years. And this happened to Nauru as well, because all the con men that you can imagine globally came out of the woodworks for both Nauru and Barnaba and tried to be the financial advisors of these phosphate natives, and usually ended up running off with chunks of their money. So any phosphate income from both Nauru and Barnaba has really only created more drama than it's worth.
Yeah, I can see how that would cause Barnaban's problems. I know more recently you focused your work on Project Barnaba. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, so Project Barnaba is a multimedia exhibition that I created based on research that I've been doing about Barnaba for a couple of decades. And I only went into academia to learn about Barnaba. I quickly realized that if a Barnaban was going to tell this story herself, the only way to do it was through something like a PhD scholarship that gave you 3 to 4 years to spend with your own history. Because as somebody who grew up in Fiji, I didn't learn anything about Barnabans and Barnaban history and how we even got to Fiji in the first place. So rather than just putting it into words in text, I decided in order to tell the story in a more dynamic and accessible way, I would like to do it creatively. But I was doing my PhD in an anthropology department, which at the time was quite rigid and narrow about what counts as academic knowledge. So the best way I could figure out how to incorporate the amazing visual archives that I was working with and interviews that I was doing with people out in the islands on Rambi, in other parts of Kiribati, and on Barnaba, was to make films. So I created 7 what I'm calling visual studies of stories related to Barnaba. And then as an academic, you're expected to turn your work into a book or journal articles or book chapters, essays. I had all this visual content and I wasn't sure what to do with it because I wasn't planning to become a documentary filmmaker or anything like that. I was just working with the sources that I was finding in the archives. So it actually took me a few years to figure out what to do with my multimedia content. And eventually I met Yuki Kihara, who is an amazing Samoan Japanese visual artist. And Yuki and I started to collaborate and to talk about how we could tell this Barnaban story in a very accessible way for the general public. And she advised that I just become a visual artist and I tell this story in my own way. So I created Project Barnaba and it has 3 parts and 3 interconnected stories about the history of phosphate mining on Barnaba and the displacement of Barnabans. One is called The Body of the Land, The Body of the People, which looks at how Barnaban and Kiribati and really general Pacific concepts of land link people, link humans and their environments in very direct, integrated, holistic ways. So in the Kiribati language, you don't say my land, you say me land, because you and the land are together. You don't possess the land. The land and you are one continued body. So Body of the Land, Body of the People kind of brings back Banaba into the space through these textiles that I hang from the ceiling, which are stamped with a timeline of key events in Banaban history and key, very confronting quotes. And then in the back of the space, I have a very large three-screen projection called Mine Lands for Teresia, who is my late sister, who was a Banaban and Kiribati poet, an activist and scholar, who really is the person who inspired me to pursue this work in the first place. And she wrote a poem called Mine Lands, which was based on the lovely song, This Land Is My Land, This Land Is Your Land. But then she goes on to talk about, and then we leased it to greedy miners who only saw this as a source of phosphate and used it for their prosperity. And then the last section of the exhibition is called Tewa's Kainga. Colonization changed how we live so much, and people used to live in a kainga. And a kainga refers to the people who live together and eat together and the land that feeds them. So your kainga is kind of like this place of feeding and nurture and all of that. And we tried to recreate this on Rambi in a little patch that our family has, where my father and his brothers and sisters created homes and people lived together. And in it, I have photographs of just Banabans hanging out every day, just getting on with life. It's in stark contrast to the other two sections of Project Banaba. It's colorful. People are fishing. They're doing their laundry. They're playing board games. They're hanging out. But I put that in that space to, you know, get us to a place of well-being and creative survival. So those are the three sections of Project Banaba. And other information and stories come to me because of Project Banaba, because for some families, it's something that they've heard through their own family stories. Most recently, Banaba faced total water shortage where people had no fresh drinking water. There's about 300 people who live there now as ongoing caretakers of Banaba. And I have two aunties who were in Kiribati at the time, who are these amazing Banaban leaders who've been trying to be part of cultural revitalization and economic self-determination for Banabans. Truly amazing women, Pelenise Alofa and Terikano Takesau, who've been in Kiribati through COVID. And through that whole process, we're still doing incredible creative things. So one auntie leads the Kiribati Climate Action Network and also runs a whole program on well-being and healing and wellness. And then Terikano runs these amazing organic, pure virgin coconut oil programs where she encourages people to make soaps and amazing coconut oil and different kinds of things for the body, which are very inspiring to a lot of Banabans and others who, you know, emerge from this particular history without a lot of help from the outside world and are trying to revitalize and self-care, like look after themselves after decades and decades of people interfering in their affairs and kind of infantilizing them. I'm very excited about the women who lead the Banabans in the space and the young people. There are young people like Re Baintes, who's a Banaban youth leader, who's also a great voice on climate change and climate action, because these Banabans know exactly the connections between the phosphate mining history and the climate change and the climate action that's needed now. So they actually, you know, they are activists in this space, advocating for Banabans, but advocating for all Pacific people and calling for other nations to do something about climate change. So we have lots of Banabans not just looking after themselves, but looking after others in their community and even beyond their community. And so I try to take Project Banaba to these spaces where we can have these conversations, not just about history, not just about the past, but about the present and about the future for Banabans.
Right. And we have talked a lot about Banaba's past and present so far. To end our discussion today, I'd like to ask you, what do you think the future of Banaba looks like?
So for the future, there's this ongoing care and safeguarding of culture so that we don't lose anymore. We know culture is always changing. Culture is not a static thing, but there are certain things that are quintessentially Banabin that Banabins are quite determined to maintain and hold on to. The other area that I think is really interesting is the kind of work that people like Terikano and Pelenise are doing. Pelenise being this leader in the climate change space and advocating and fighting for climate action, really on a not just on a local level, but a regional and an international level, and linking it back to healing and wellness. So it's sort of like healing for historical trauma as much as thinking about this potentially dire climactic future. And then Terikano is leading all kinds of organic initiatives where it's about training others across the Banabin community to be self-sufficient through the kinds of products that they produce. And they don't just work on virgin coconut oil, which is always in high demand in the Pacific and elsewhere, but they revitalize weaving and crafts and all kinds of different Banabin arts, which, as I mentioned before, for even communities in the diaspora are so critical and important. So all of that's happening, but the one thing that we definitely need and ought to happen going into the future is rehabilitation of the island. The island at the moment is riddled with asbestos. They're living in a kind of a post-apocalyptic mining site where there's at one point no fresh water, and the fresh water had to be brought in on ships, which leads to other kinds of health problems. So people need to take responsibility and fix Banaba. And they need to do it with Banabans, not just like, you know, drop in from the sky, to go back to that metaphor of land from the sky, but to actually talk to Banaban communities, find out what they want and they need and what the best way might be of rehabilitating the island, planting trees, bringing back some soil or leveling pinnacles, figuring out what to do with these limestone pinnacles, etc. So the future for Banaba does need to be rehabilitation and justice, environmental, social, political, and economic justice, but it must be done in consultation and dialogue and preferably led by Banabans themselves.
Thanks so much for joining us. If you've enjoyed this interview, give us a shout on Instagram or Twitter and let us know what you think. Or better yet, become a member of Peeps and leave Kristen or Katarina notes for yourself. They'd love to hear from you.